everyone, welcome to the Boas podcast with your hosts Keith McPeak, Rob Stone and myself, Warren Booth. And tonight we have a very special guest, Ketzel Dwyer. How you doing? Excellent. How are you?
I'm good. Enjoying nice cool weather in Texas right now.
What is cool in Texas? Is that like 97 or 100 or what is it?
Oh, no. It's like 65 right now. It's been hot last few days.
Yeah. It's just starting to warm up here in Virginia. So it's amazing how at night it can still be pretty cold. But in my community, there's a bunch of relief ponds, but the frogs are just going insane.
Right.
Yeah, which is good to know.
It's a nice time for critters.
Yeah. It just means that if I ever need amphibians for scenting, I can just walk out my door and find them within 100 feet.
Right. That's
yeah, which is excellent. So Keith, how are you?
So Quetzal, I'm going to jump in here. I just wanted to like, you know, talk about how you and I met and then about the history on you with the reptiles and getting started and where you wound up today. But I think you and I met maybe in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, New York.
You know, I had a weekend job working in a reptile store in Flushing, Queens. It didn't really strike me as a job, you know, because it was so much fun. Yeah. I was a hobbyist my whole life. You know, I've been playing with just like everyone else who's here. I've been interested in it since I was, you know, crawling. But that was that time frame when I met Keith was when when I first got, a window into the business end of it, which was an interesting to see.
Right.
I'm not specialized on boas. I've always liked boas and pythons, but there's a lot of other stuff I like as well. I like big colubrids, like Hydrodynastes and Drymarchon. I like monitor lizards. I like aquatic lizards. I like water turtles. I'm not really a morph guy. I'm not a morph guy, and I'm not an amphibian guy. But everything else on this side of the fence, you know, I'm fairly into.
Yeah, and the store you worked in at the time was a pretty specialized reptile store. It was unlike most pet stores would be considered, you know.
Yeah.
Definitely specialized in reptiles.
Yeah, the only other before that there was a couple other ones in New York. There was one called Fang and Claw.
Right.
On West 14th Street. But I mean that wasn't really much of a store. It was the guy was open from four to seven. And you know, it was basically his wife wouldn't let him keep animals at home.
Right.
And so that's how he did it after work. And, you know, he had good stuff and, you know, he was very knowledgeable. His name was Aldo Passara. You knew him, right, Keith?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was that. And then Philippe de Vaujolais had a store with some partners uptown on the east side. It was called Small Worlds. There was a nice store because, I mean, you know, not surprisingly, if Philippe was involved, there was a lot of love went into it and everything was planted and hooked up. And that was a really nice place.
Yeah. And then from there, I remember you telling, I think I was there with John Wilborg and you were telling us how you were going to take off to the Canary Islands.
Yeah, I was at an IHS in, I think it was like 87 or so. And I got friendly with this English guy there who had a place in the Canary Islands. And, you know, they were giving me a hard time about drinking there because I was underage. And then they were giving him a hard time about smoking a cigar. And he was like, can you believe these people are telling me I'm invading their airspace with a cigar? And so we got to know each other. And I saw him a couple of years after that. And the lease on my apartment was about up. So, you know, half joking, I asked him if I wanted to if he needed a, you know, an extra hand out there. And he said, yeah, in about 3 months. And that was just when my lease was up. So I made plans to go over there and work. You know, I had up until that point, I hadn't really decided on, I didn't want to pursue a career in reptiles because I wanted to, I was concerned that doing it for money might, you know, desensitize me. It might ruin it for me.
Right.
I wanted to keep it pure, for lack of a better word. But then after working, I was over there for what, 6 months. And he had a similar background as me. You know, I don't have higher education. And so that fact intimidated me, but you know, that guy, had the similar background as me. And then I was like, okay, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. You know, I learned to speak Spanish over there, and I had some good connections in Costa Rica. I'd grown up with some Costa Rican guys who brought me down there. And so we leapfrogged like the tourist hustle and all that. And I bought some land and slowly but surely put a place together down there. I was there for 25 years. I had a really good run down there. I bred loads of stuff. You know, I was very happy, but then the laws just got too ridiculous, you know, which is a sad but true trend in a lot of the world right now. There's a great article out right now on how Australia is losing a generation of biologists, because I mean, you know, as you know, a biologist, you know, you're not going to, it's hard enough, you know, you're not going to make a fortune doing that anyway. The laws make it so much harder in certain places like that, that it becomes like not fun anymore. And it's, you know, in Costa Rica, I got to a point where, you know, I would have like a clutch of some super rare animal and, you know, thinking to myself, you know, I didn't really care at this point towards the end of it, if the eggs hatch or not, because what am I going to do with them? And, you know, so then it was, it became time to go. And I moved up to, Texas, Johnson City. In Texas, every county might as well be a different world. You know, there's some places that are as restrictive as California, and there's some places like Blanco County where I'm at, where you can have a rhino and nobody will bother you, you know, and it's like, I want to dedicate my attention to the animals as opposed to negotiating the paperwork and the stupidity. So that's how I ended up here. But, you know, during the time that I was in Central America, you know, I traveled all over Latin America and other parts of the world. You know, I ran into a lot of neat boas, in Costa Rica and elsewhere. So yeah, I'm be happy to share any experiences that I've had in Latin America with boas in the wild or in captivity. And I don't know. You tell me where you want me to start. You want me to start working southward or north or?
Well, the snake that intrigues me most in the world and the snake that I would love to have more than anything else right now, I'd give everything up to keep, would be the eyelash boas.
And, oh yeah, those are great.
And I know you've developed a pretty good area where you can go find them pretty regularly. I've seen pictures of stuff that you found with Ari and all that kind of stuff. So if you want to start with that species, I'd be
okay. Right. Yeah. So I'll work north with the boa experiences. So yeah, when I went to Ecuador a couple times looking for eyelash boas. That's what Ari was really focusing on. I've always thought they were cool. I had never even seen a live one before. I had friends there, and they had informed me that they're fairly common, or the Boulangeri is fairly common. According to the latest statistics, nobody has seen Gularis in many years, and their habitat is pretty degraded. So those have not, Gularis has not been confirmed in recent years, which is sad. And, you know, those were an old buddy of mine, Jerry Marzek. I'm sure you know him. He used to breed those back in the old days. So it's pretty tragic that those didn't get, established in captivity.
Yeah.
But, the Boulangeri, I remember, you know, when people had them in captivity, they'd feed them fish. And, you know, in the beginning, I thought that, you know, there was a frog eater in the wild, and, you know, fish was just a captive substitute because, you know, I've played around with a lot of frog eating snakes, and I've never come across a frog eating snake that I couldn't get to eat fish. But I turned out to be, I was proved wrong there because you can find the Bolangeri in the Choco, which is the forest that is west of the Andes that extends from Panama through Colombia and into Ecuador. Mm-hmm. Until very recently, the Colombian Choco was pretty much off limits because of FARC activity. And the Panamanian Choco, to get into Tracheboa habitat, is pretty hard to get to as well. You have to charter a plane and you have to bring your own water, from what I was told. And that's the end of the range, and there's only a few Panamanian records of Tracheboa. So the place to see Tracheboa Bolangeri is in Ecuador. And they're not rare at all. You know, you can find several in a night. And all of the ones that we found were along streams with their heads in the water fishing. Wow. You know, Keith, I'm sure you've seen your earless monitors do that.
Yeah.
You know, they're out of the water with their faces just in the water waiting for something to touch them or come close.
Right.
Yeah, it's the same hunting technique. And we got to see one that had its face in a pool, and there was a little catfish there. You know, we nudged the catfish and it grabbed the catfish and constricted it, and we videotaped it and took loads of pictures and documented it for HERP review.
Wow.
But those are also a lot bigger than you would expect. I mean, I would say some of them, some of the ones, they get about as big around as a quarter. So it's a stocky snake. It's not like a little, it's not like a little worm by any means. You know, they remind me of, the live ones reminded me of viper boas.
Yeah. And do you find them mostly by the streams, or are they on the forest floor away from streams, or everyone you encounter typically by water?
All of the ones that we found were by streams. I mean, there's records of them being taken away from streams, but I don't know if that's a seasonal thing or not. I don't think that that's been well studied. But there's a number of HERP people in Ecuador who are doing a lot of serious work these days. So that would be an interesting study, you know, to track to see if it's like a seasonal thing, if they move to the streams or not.
Right.
Or there's different subpopulations. It's quite interesting. And they can – Tracheboa, actually, you know, one thing that I was shocked about is, you know, they're fairly slow on land, but they swim quickly. Or they're capable of swimming pretty quickly.
Yeah, they're a cool species.
But that was
a neat snake before the python and boa split. You know, they're on the phylogenetic tree.
Yeah, really they went on there. Yeah, it's a very, very neat animal.
So are they ever exported? Was there ever any export permits to bring them out?
Historically, some came in, but you know, Ecuador is very, very strict, and Colombia is not much better, and Panama is not really, it's not practical. Mm-hmm. But you know, which is sad. Mm-hmm. But they're not. They're fairly common, so it's. I would guess if somebody were set up down there to do all the paperwork and get captive bred ones, they could come out. But I don't see it happening in the near future.
No,
because it's like you need to know somebody on the ground who's really into it, and the people who I know in Ecuador are more venomous snake oriented. With nothing wrong with that. There's plenty of cool venomous snakes in Ecuador. But on the subject of Ecuador, when we were there, we also collected Corallus bloombergi.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Which is a neat snake. It's it's like an isolated population of Annulatus, but I think the classification is correct as far as them being different, because they're, you know, the color change that they do is a lot more dramatic than Annulatus does. And in general, they seem to to be a larger snake than annulatus. Or they can get larger, and yeah, I think I agree with that classification. But on the subject of Ecuador, there's also there's a population of Imperator or Imperator complex that lives on the Pacific coast. That's mostly black. I'm aware of about, I'd say, six photos of different snakes that are, you know, basically black Imperator that live in the mangroves there. I saw some captive ones. We went looking for them in the wild, but didn't find any. But one of my friends down there, Maria Elena Barragan, you know, we did some, I forgot who she sent it to, but she did some shed work, sent some sheds to somebody, and they didn't come out genetically distinct. But I mean, it's like if there's a black boa that lives in the mangroves and just a few kilometers away, they're regular. Mm-hmm. You know, come on, there's got to be something.
So these are, I think I've seen pictures of these. These are the ones that are kind of black and patternless. Is that right?
Yes, black and patternless. I mean, not black like a Bolens, but you know,
but like a gray slaty kind of.
Yeah, like a smoke, like a grayish ash black color.
Yeah, and patternless, you know.
Yeah, and completely patternless, not the hint of a pattern.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I was very curious to see what babies of those look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was thinking about those a while back, and I was wondering, you know, I haven't seen the genetic work to see if they're how different or what markers they use to determine that. But, you know, in a mangrove, I suppose there's some level of isolation depending on salinity and stuff like that there. But it'd be unusual for them to be so isolated that you don't see some level of gene flow. And therefore, if that was right, so just think about it like boa constrictor, boa imperator sabugai, or even hog islands that are imperator. And you see those that they're naturally occurring super hypomelanistic form. There's no heterozygous. There's no non hypomelanistic. So you've had a level of isolation and then selection for these hypomelanistic traits that has eventually resulted in the super hypomelanistic or homozygous hypomelanistic trait being fixed. And I was curious whether this was the same thing. You know, whether this was a genetic variant from that original population that was patternless. And that was then selected for because it probably has some level of advantage in regards to being more cryptic. You know, against this kind of limbs and stuff like that there.
Yeah, I have no idea what kind of why they would have that specialized colors, because there's plenty of snakes that live in mangroves and eat birds. Mm-hmm. And I'm not aware of any that have evolved that color. I mean, there's some, what is it? There's a black population of purple maculatus, but I don't know. That's the only reference I can think. You know, Ruchenberger, I like mangroves as well.
Yeah.
Those are not black.
What I will say about the Ruchenberger that I've got, so I've got Trinidad Ruchenberger, and they're very uniform in color. Very different than the mainland Ruchenberger that I've got, like from Venezuela, that have got pattern. But again, it could just be an island isolation thing. You know, like I think, you know, there are some pictures of patterned Ruchenberger on Trinidad, but we more often than not, you see these uniform bronze or gold animals. Sometimes slate gray, but very rarely gray one. Patterned ones. Yeah, yeah. All of mine are bronze or gold, and as babies, any litters that are born, they're from my ones. They're all bright orange.
Right. Yeah. Hey, before I forget this, I want to share something regarding the Trinidad Venezuelan ones. I'll mm-hmm. send you this picture later on. I got my hands on some Venezuelan Ruchenbergeri when I was in Costa Rica.
Yeah,
and I got a picture of one doing something really interesting. It's got its tail in the sun in a certain, in, the tail is in a patch of sunlight.
Yeah.
And the tail is like, looks like it's like almost red and like transparent.
Hmm.
And it looks like, yeah, it was like caught luring. I only saw them do that a couple times, and I never saw them. I mean, I never tried to feed them, like put any warblers or anything like that in there, but it was.
Yeah.
But it's a neat picture. I sent it to Robert Henderson.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I sent it through because I know that, you know, I've sometimes seen, because I got a lot of Rischenbergeri, and I've seen sometimes where they lay with their tail kind of exposed whenever I've used UV light.
And I've kind of
put that down to like a cryptic basking. You know, where the body is actually sitting underneath cover on a branch, you know, because I put in like these kind of palm type leaves and so they're covered, but the tail will sit out, you know, and it's almost as if they're warming up, kind of the opposite of a blackhead, you know, where you think a blackhead of python sticking its head out of a burrow and warming up pretty quickly. And I was always curious whether it was just a form of cryptic basking. And that's, and I was wondering why on some of the Venezuelan animals and on all of the Costa Rican animals, you see they have got black tails.
Right.
You know, and, you know, the black allowing them to absorb heat very quickly. I wondered whether that was just kind of a way of avoiding predation and stuff like that there. But in your case, you know, and the tails, even on my Venezuelan animals, the only ones that don't have some level of variation in the tail are animals that I've got that are patternless slate gray.
Right.
But the other ones have some level of mark, some level of tail differentiation. So I was always curious whether that would be an adaptive mechanism for cryptic basking. But I suppose it's something that hasn't been lived into.
Yeah, it seems like one thing about Rischenbergeri is I've noted that like in Costa Rica there was very little variation.
Yeah,
you know, they all pretty much look the same. However, I'm still kicking myself to this day for not doing this. In southern Costa Rica, there's a valley that's dry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was about like 3 hours from me to get to. And, you know, it's got an endemic little viper that lives there, Porphyrium volcanicum.
Uh-huh.
And there was the guy who I knew out there, you know, he sent me a picture of some Rischenbergeri from there that had a lot of pattern. You know, they looked almost like Colombian or Venezuelan ones from the Llanos.
Right.
And I didn't go and pick them up, which I'm kicking myself for.
Yeah, you know, so I'm wondering, when you've got that area of dry forest, you know, that is somewhat acts as a barrier to dispersal, and you've got that potential for, you know, some level of migration over thousands and thousands of years from the southern population into the north, you know, that could be the boundary.
Right.
There's been very, very little genetic work done on Rischenbergeri other than showing that the southern populations, Colombia, Venezuela, Trinidad, are genetically distinct from the Costa Rican. So they form two different grades.
It's also something to consider with that. It's like there's a, for lack of a better word, there's a leakage of Central American snakes that comes into South America. One comes down the Pacific coast of Colombia into the Chocó, because there's a lot of Central American stuff that comes in there, like Ungulofus and Diploglossus, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the other leakage comes over into the Venezuelan Andes. It follows the Caribbean coast of Colombia over to Venezuela, and there you have Bothrops asper and stuff like that there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rischenbergeri distribution does not fall into that category.
Right.
It's completely different. They follow the coast and they get pretty deep into the Colombian Llanos and Venezuelan Llanos.
Mm-hmm.
And they go all the way to Trinidad into Guyana.
Right. So they go into Guyana as well. Interesting.
That's what they say. I mean, that's what the literature says. I mean, I would be interested to see how that works.
Mm-hmm.
To see if in Guyana that's like a coastal
species,
if they're limited to the mangroves.
It would be interesting, you know, because given that Hortulana is so widely distributed in Guyana, you'd wonder, you know, that if the
how
do they keep different? So you
work? I mean,
yeah, at that point, I would be expecting that just to be a massive hybrid zone.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's either it would either be a massive hybrid zone or the Rutenbergerites are strictly limited, are strictly mangroves. Niche
partitioning, yeah, right.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. You know, the people that I've talked to about collecting Rutenbergerite across the range have always said that they often find them most often associated with mangroves.
Right, but I mean, it's like they're common in mangroves, but in Costa Rica and Venezuela and Colombia, they're not limited to mangroves.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I suppose, the other thing is that these are people that are primarily going along rivers and so on, so they're obviously going to be seeing them more often if they're not actually inland and looking for them.
Right.
You know.
Right. Exactly. And it's like
it's just a sampling bias.
I mean, I personally think that, you know, it is that is a species that likes mangroves and riverine habitats, but, you know, that can be with other species, it can be, you know, edge habitats and riverside habitats is an illusion, because it's like if an animal comes to a barrier, it's either going to go left or right.
Right.
Uh-huh. It's not going to go straight back.
Yeah.
And so you're going to find. Exactly. So it's, you know, the number.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But Rutenbergerite, that's a very neat snake.
Yeah, they really are. You know, I've got Costa Rican, Venezuelan, and Trinidad animals, and the variation is incredible. Like, Venezuela is phenotypically so diverse. You know, a whole bunch of animals have come in from Venezuela recently over the last couple of years. Talking to different people, it's interesting to see what they come in as. I had a guy yesterday telling me they came in from Colombia as annulated tree boas, and I didn't believe that for a minute. Talking to other people, they said they've come in from Guyana as hortulana.
That's believable.
Yeah, exactly. And quite a few of them have come in actually over the last few years. So there's clearly somebody bringing them in deliberately because they go for a little bit higher than a regular hortulana. But the variation is interesting. But also it would be interesting to know across that range where hortulana also occurs and whether you get hybrids forming. Right. Because sometimes you see Rutenbergerite from Venezuela that they're difficult to differentiate from hortulana. You know, only adult size is the difference, you know.
Right. And I've seen that. I've had people send me Guyanese that were supposedly from Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's like if they're from Guyana or shipped out of Guyana, that's
right.
Asking me to identify them. And it's like, it's honestly, I can't, I wasn't much help, you know, because it's like, first, I don't know where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the hybrid thing figures into the equation as well.
Right. Indeed. Yeah. There's
It could be somebody just being opportunistic and telling lies to put a.
Yeah. You know, there was a litter born a year or two ago from a friend who'd got animals as Rutenbergerite. They were sold to him as Trinidads, but it was pretty clear they're not Trinidad. But it then gave birth within a month or 6 weeks, and the babies looked like hortulanas.
Right.
So the question is, are they hortulanas? And if so, was that through, you know, because I'm sure it takes them a while to collect enough of these and bring them in to then export them. You know, could that have occurred in a holding cage? You know, same as you find with the hybrid Amazon emerald tree boas. You know, the question is, did that mating occur while they were being held before they were shipped, or did it occur in the wild? It's interesting, but I've seen a lot of variation in neonate Rutenbergerite, especially Venezuelan and adults. You know, I've seen bright red patternless ones right the way through to highly, you know, patternless and gray.
Have you ever seen ones from Tobago?
Yes, I've seen and very highly patterned.
Right. Years ago, I had a stopover in Trinidad. I mean, I didn't really get to do any herping, but I went to the zoo and I chatted it up with the, keeper there.
Uh-huh.
And he told me that on Tobago, they got huge. They got bigger than the mainland Trinidadian ones. He said about as big around as an orange, if not bigger.
Jeez, right. Because my ones, you know, my ones eat large rats. And they make very little of a dent on them. You know, they can get really huge. 9 day different. You know, the Costa Rica ones I've got are probably six and a half foot, and they all eat a medium rat very easily and a large rat. Right. These Trinidad ones are just 9 day different. Like they look like amethystine pythons sitting on a branch. They're huge.
Right.
So to see if Trinidad or Tobago ones were bigger, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, I need to make it to Tobago one of these days. I think you know where we're starting to go with this. I mean, I think it's likely that you know, the Venezuelan, Trinidadian, Colombian complex are going to prove to be something different than the other than the Costa Rican, Panamanian.
Yeah,
Russian burglary.
You know, it's the genetic work that's been done on them so far, and I don't know if you've seen the paper, but I can send it to you.
No, I have not. Shows, I would like to see that.
Yeah, it shows a clear differentiation between Costa Rica and those from Trinidad and Venezuela. You know, they form into two different clades. You know, and that makes sense. You know, because having them here, right in front of me, where I get, like, I've got a picture that I took. It's probably the only picture in the world of this, but it's a neonate Costa Rican, Venezuelan, and Trinidad, and right. The size of the babies are totally different. Their behavior is totally different. I don't know if you've seen that there. Costa Rica, they're relatively placid for a tree boa.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the Trinidad and Venezuela is no way.
Right. You know, yeah. and feeding is different as well. So my Costa Ricans, I think my Costa Ricans actually were originated from you, I think.
Where else would they come from?
15 years, right. And I was actually in Costa Rica whenever I bought them. I was teaching a course and I found them on Cameron's on list and I paid for them.
They were definitely from
Costa Rica. Yeah. And getting those feeding, super warm defrost rat pinks. And at most I need to scent with some like chicken broth or whatever. Trinidad ones in Venezuelan have been an absolute nightmare for me.
Really?
I've tried. You know, the only thing I haven't tried are lizards because I haven't been able to get any, but I've tried all of these little, you know, the snake or the lizard sausages and the frog sausages, right. The lizard scent, the frog scent, chicken broth, and everything. And they just haven't, the babies of the last litter just have had no interest in even striking, which has been weird.
Right.
So the next litter I'm going to set up very differently. I'm probably going to keep in a large enclosure as a group. And, right. And try and offer differently. But yeah, they just talk about driving me insane.
Yeah, it happened.
Yeah, but given the rarity, you know, the only true kind of Trinidads in captivity, it's kind of like, you know, I'm not going to give up on these things. I'll just pull my hair out and eventually go.
No, absolutely not.
yeah, very, very cool animals. So I wouldn't be surprised when work is done that actually splits those apart. Just like, I don't know if you've seen the emerald tree boas from, you know, the kind of far kind of Peru kind of region. That, you know,
yeah, those are what I would refer to as the true Batesai.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the holotype of Batesai was from somewhere up there in the, I don't remember if it was Peru or Colombia, but it was the western Amazon.
Right.
And those, you know, there has been some, I haven't seen any papers, but I know somebody who knew somebody who was doing some genetic stuff with those, and it's, Those are quite different from the ones, the Batesai that are in captivity. The Batesai that are in captivity are, you know, those originate from the eastern, eastern part of the range.
Yeah. Yeah. The genetic work that I've seen on those, the genetic differentiation between the Batesai that we've seen in captivity and the caninus, between those two is actually quite minimal, maybe 4 or 5% in relation to what we see between the,
right, that's what I was Peruvian, told as well.
It's really high, genetically very distinct. But whenever you look at them, they're very different as well. You know,
right?
To the untrained eye, people might look at them and just think they're not a Batesai with a slightly different pattern, but they're very different animals.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. But the whole corral is complex. I think, you know, once genetic work is finally done or will ever be done, I think it's going to split those apart even further.
Yeah.
And what will be interesting, I think the Kukai and Grenadensis might all get sunk into each other because there's very little genetic differentiation among that group.
Right, that's true.
Islands. Yeah.
But you know, it's very trendy, for lack of a better word, you know, to split stuff based on geographic range as opposed to, you know, hard science.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was a classic way. Yeah, like years ago, I saw that years ago with lots of different species.
But yeah, speaking of that, you remember we talked years back about the Honduran and Guatemalan annulatus being different?
Yeah, so genetically, whenever I screened this for a handful of markers, they didn't come out as being different. But I want to go back to those because we're using different methods now for amplifying entire mitochondria, mitochondrial genomes, and also adding nuclear data to it at a higher resolution. And I'm wondering, will something come out from that? Because the pictures that you showed me, they look like a very different animal.
There is a barrier as well, because it's like, you know, most people think of Honduras as like dripping rainforest.
Yeah.
But Honduras on the, just north of the Mesquitia, the Mesquitia is dripping rainforest, and that's where, you know, the normal annulatus that we know, you know, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and into the Mesquitia. But then on, you know, Honduras is more east, west, than north and south, or at least this part of it. So as you start going west, you know, the dry forest in Honduras gets very close to the ocean.
And
so you can find, you know, a lot of dry forest species. There's a barrier there, which is dry forest. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can find Loxosceamus and, you know, Porphyrium ophiomagus and rattlesnakes.
Right.
Caribbean habitat.
Yeah, you should there. Describe these.
And then
should,
on the other you should, side.
You should describe these for people that haven't seen the pictures. I've been very lucky to see the pictures and stuff. But if you could describe those for the kind of listeners, that would be great.
Describe a Honduran Guatemalan one?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. They seem to me to be more less laterally compressed than a regular annulatus. They're more round, like more like a Ruschenbergeri.
Yeah.
The pattern is more faded, and there's less rings. The face is a little different. And from what I've seen, you know, I'm not going to lie, I haven't seen a tremendous series, but, you know, including pictures, preserved ones, ones that I bred myself, ones that people I know have bred, I've seen zero variation in that population. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the Panamanian, Costa Rican, Nicaraguan ones are quite variable. Everybody knows that.
Yeah. From what and they were golden in color, right? Kind of yellowy gold.
Yeah, it's like kind of a, let's say,
straw color,
like a beige. Yeah, like a beige bleached color.
Mm-hmm.
But
was there
one
any
thing
size
that's
variation?
About it? I've seen decent sized ones.
Okay.
I mean, nothing like whoa, but you know, that's as big, if not bigger, than any annulatus that I've seen in Costa Rica, and I've seen scores of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The big thing for me, whenever I saw the pictures you'd sent me, was the body shape, totally different than annulatus that I've got here, and any other annulatus.
Yeah, exactly. It's round. It's like it's more like a Ruschenbergeri. I mean, it's not like. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's definitely worth. I mean, it seems like it has all the makings for something different. Right. It's an isolated population, and you know, to our eyes, there's several differences.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, you know, who knows what's going on, you know, in genetically.
Yeah. Right. So do you still have access to
them? I mean, you're the guy to talk to about that. Oh, no, I do not. Yeah. I mean, I do access, meaning, okay, I'm still on good terms with the people at UTA, and there's some pickled ones there.
Yeah.
And I could probably, I got friends in Guatemala, so I could probably get my hands on a shed skin, but live ones.
Yeah.
Live ones, I don't have access to.
That's a pity. Very, very cool.
But,
when I look at Corrales and rare Corrales, that's one that sticks out. That and Crupani, you know, are the two that I'm like, wow.
Different. Yeah, you and everybody else at the Crupani.
But, you know, bringing Crupani into it, they're almost similar to Rauschenberger in terms of their body structure. You know, they're more round than they're laterally compressed. And it's the same with these here Añeladas or whatever they would be, you know.
Yeah, I had a theory on Crupani that, you know, proved to be wrong. That I was going to, you know, some years ago, I tried to get into the area. Mm-hmm. But it was a very restricted area, and my friend couldn't get us in there, so we didn't go. But, you know, my theory, which proved to be wrong on the Crupani, was the people were looking for him in the wrong places, and that it was a rattlesnake mimic.
So, you know, that the recent animals that have been found over the last handful of years, they've picked up a handful of them over the last 5 years. And they've, from what I know, they've all been on the ground crossing roads.
Right. But I mean, then again, there's all.
But then with
deforestation. I know people, hunters in Suriname, who said that they sometimes see emeralds crossing the road.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's like there's not.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose whenever you've got a lot of habitat fragmentation, then there's a requirement at some point in time to move.
That's where people, I mean, it's a more practical way to search is road cruising than spotlighting.
Yeah, the way they've been picking them up is, I think they've been putting out notices, you know, have you seen this snake kind of thing, and people are bringing them in. Either road killed or killed recently, but they brought in some fresh ones. And I know that they had a pair that they were holding in captivity for a little bit. And I'd hope that they would hold onto them and try and breed them. Cause what a neonate.
Crupani. Right. Nobody,
like, nobody knows.
Nobody has any idea,
you know, and,
maybe it's the reason why they're so apparently rare is because the neonates are frog specialists or something like that. Something weird.
Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. You know, that wouldn't surprise me. They're just fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, sadly, it's one that, you know, there's a lot of species that I look at that I think, well, we will one day see them in captivity. That's not one of them.
not outside of Brazil. I mean, it's...
No. Yeah.
You know, people do have collections in Brazil, but it's, you know, the laws there are brutal as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything needs to get chipped and, you know, the front glass and a whole bunch of other silliness.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
We would never see them. We'd never see them up here.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you look at them phylogenetically, they sit in between Caninus and Rauschenbergeri. They're like kind of the intermediate step. Sorry, Caninus and Añeladas, sorry. They're kind of like the intermediate step between those two. You know, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, Caninus remind me I think Caninus and Añeladas are more of a similar, more similar to each other than people think.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, you know, we had Dennis McNamara on a couple of weeks ago. That episode hasn't gone out yet, but Dennis is the, do you know Dennis McNamara, the curator at of reptiles at Virginia Zoo? And
I know who he is. I might have met him once or twice, but I don't have a relationship with him.
Yeah, super nice guy, really great guy. But I was over at the zoo a bunch of months back, and I was walking past. He was giving me a tour, and I was walking past some of the exhibits, and I looked in, and I thought I was looking at a group of Western Sanzania, and what I was actually looking at were just massive Añeladas, like the biggest that I've ever seen. These were. You know, it looked like they could have tackled a large rat easily.
Añeladas do get big. I mean, I wrote it up in some years ago in Herp Review. There was, I believe it was a spiny rat that it had in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the ones that a Bushmaster ate, but it was something that was noteworthy.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, we think in captivity that, you know, Corrales should eat small food. And, you know, I'm not above that. I always feed my Corrales small food, but I've found that one had a huge rat in it. And that was a wild one. And, you know, I've found Russian burger eye, you know, with big iguanas in their bellies.
Oh yeah. You know, I've said it before, you know, my caninus, I feed some of the females, I feed large rats too, and it hardly makes a dent on them.
Right.
And you know, my big Russian burger eye females from Trinidad, they would take a lot smaller to large, kind of largish rat easily, you know, and it doesn't really make a dent. But I'd always thought annulatus, you know, they almost appear more like hortulanus. But,
right.
You know, but they're not. They're in between caninus and Russian burger eye. And as right. a result, they can get big, you know. They, you know, and I think probably in captivity, they're probably being restrained a little bit in terms of the size that they could get to based on the diet they're being fed.
Right.
Cool snakes. I just need to find a
male
for my females.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Very neat.
But Keith, you're awful quiet over there.
Oh, man, I'm just enjoying the stores.
All right.
And I'm wondering what species you're going to move on to next.
Oh, I don't know. Sky's the limit.
So what about your experience with Tropidophis?
Okay. I collected this is kind of a funny story. The only Tropidophis that I've collected were in Cuba. This funny story is I was in a place called Soroa, which is in western Cuba. And, you know, at this time, you know, I don't know how it is now, but, you know, traveling in Cuba, you know, they try to keep, like, tourists on a leash. And, you know, that's obviously not my style. I don't want to look at, you know, Fidel Castro's birthplace or any of that shit. I don't care about that. So what we did was we, you know, just, you know, got friendly with a cab driver and said we want to go to Soroa, you know, which is this collective space, a place where a lot of stuff has been collected. And then you go over to the guy's house and then he's, oh yeah, my cousin's nephew's brother-in-law or something like that lives there. And, you know, cut a deal that we would stay in the house for, you know, they'd cook for us for like $30 a night or whatever. And so we made our way to Soroa. And then, you know, I asked the woman whose house it was, you know, what the scenario was. I said, I want to go out at night and look for snakes. Is that going to be a problem? And then she gestured at a house, you know, a light up on the hill, and she's like, okay, yeah, just don't go anywhere near that house because there's a very special little boy there on vacation with his father. And then I was like, oh, could that be Ilian Gonzalez? Because this was when all that was, you know, big news. And I was like, okay, point taken. I'm not going anywhere near that house. So we spent a few days there and found Melanoris, which are pretty common. Found some Melanoris. We found Pardalis as well. Cool. Which I recently learned that Pardalis eat a lot of slugs in the wild, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Wow.
And that's not a typical boid food.
No.
And we found a feckeye. Nice. You know, the black and white banded ones, which is gorgeous.
Wow.
But that's the limit of my experience with Tropidophis. I've been in Dominican Republic a couple times. I didn't collect any Tropidophis there, which is interesting because I was told they were common. But while we're on this subject, in Dominican Republic, we found loads and loads of striatus. And they were a lot of them were out during the day. And it wasn't, I'm not talking about just gravid females. I'm not talking about the coldest days in the winter. It was hot. But those are, in my experience, at least, more diurnal than people would imagine.
So these are the Chilobothrus, right? These are the...
Yes.
Yeah.
And
what's the common name for striatus?
Either Haitian boa or Dominican Haitian red boa, mountain boa.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But those do... those seem to benefit from humanity being around because it's like there's a lot of avocado plantations there. And, you know, you've seen avocado trees before. They've got tons of holes in them and a lot of shelter. And So those are pretty common. I did not get to find Gracilis, which I would have liked to have seen. We found a Fordi in the desert area near close to the Haitian border. But the Gracilis is, that's a very, very unique snake. That's a, you know, it's like an Imantotes that's got a little boa head on it. Yeah, you know, pictures don't really capture how cool they are.
Yeah, Imantotes. While we're not, while we're deviating from boas a little bit, Imantotes, man, whenever I spend time in Costa Rica in the rainforest, they're my favorite species to find because they're just so absurd.
Yeah, they're very, very charming, but it's like, picture one of those with a little boa head on it. You know,
wow.
Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah.
But, but I've got a project in the works to explore an island off of Honduras called Swan Island. Mm-hmm. It's between Grand Cayman and Guanaja in Honduras, and it's technically a Caribbean island, and they're going to build a prison there. And myself and a Honduran colleague, we just got the paperwork, you know, to go collect some of the endemic species there.
Cool.
You know, for assurance colonies, because they're, you know, building a maximum security prison there is not going to be good for the fauna.
No.
But, you know, I'm fantasizing about finding a Neutrophidophis there.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool.
Because if you know, there used to be Hutias there. Uh-huh. And you would think that if, like, the island is old enough to be colonized by a mammal.
Yeah.
You know,
Neutrophidophis
could make it.
Yeah.
Could make it there as well.
You might see some interesting Imperator there as well.
Oh, no, there's no Imperator there. Because, I mean, it's a Caribbean island. It belongs to Honduras, but it's like everything, all of the fauna is Caribbean influenced.
Really? Oh, interesting.
But, yeah, on the subject of that, I've been in Honduras a number of times as well. I've collected Imperator on Roatan.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they were neat, but they weren't, they had like a hint of orange around the faces.
Yeah.
But there was nothing really exaggerated about them.
Right.
Yeah, but
it isn't, if you look at the Bay Islands, you know, you see a decent amount of variation, you know, between Utila, Chaos Coquinus, and so on, and comparing to mainland, you will see some interesting variation among the boas that are there on those different islands. Obviously, the Chaos Coquinus, the two islands there, the boas are absolutely identical. But
right, but you know what's interesting about that is that it's like, you know, the Bay Islands, the Roatan, Guanaja, Utila, those are a lot mm-hmm. further out to sea than Chaos Coquinus, the Hog Island.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the ones that are the most distinct are the Hog Island ones.
Right. Yeah, they are.
But I mean, to me, that's because of, you know, they were not obligated to evolve on the Bay Island, but the Hog Islands were because of, you know, they're you know, a typical small pale bird eating island boa.
Yeah, I think part of it is like whenever you look at the other Bay Islands, you know, in relation to the Hog Islands, they're much bigger. The islands are much bigger,
and it's because of the food. There's still
right.
There's I forgot how you say it in English. It's like a watusa in Spanish. It's like a guti or paca. It's the one that doesn't have any spots.
Right.
Those are on Roatan, and I don't know about Utila and Guanaja, but they're. But you know, they weren't obligated to speciate.
Right, and I think I've mentioned on this before. You know, the animals that we've seen on the Chaos Coquinus, they're small, right? You know, the 3 to 4 foot arboreal. And I was curious, I talked to a couple of people that work there a lot with the boas, and they'd said it's not uncommon to find big ones, you know, in the 6 foot, 6.5 foot range, but he said they're broomstick thin because there's not a diet for them.
Yeah, Keith, maybe you remember this. There was one, cause, you know, people had always talked about the Hog Island boas as being small. There was one that they had at Reptilia that was obviously an import. That was about 6 feet. Do you remember that snake?
I do.
Yeah, and it only ate pigeons. They had to send one of the guys out to go catch pigeons. And so it's like, you know, a thin 6-foot boa that only wants to eat pigeons, you know, that's not captive bred.
No, definitely not.
But
yeah, so the fact that you see them in captivity and they're 6 feet and they're eating large rats, it doesn't surprise me. You know, and whenever people are, they're always saying that they're all, that as a result, they're all hybrid or integrates with Colombian boas. You know, clearly you can see the difference in it.
Okay, I'm not sure if I believe that. I just think it's like, you know, there's a lot of species that are dwarfs in the wild.
Yeah, but they're not
like Crotalus grandis and stuff like that. You know, they're dwarfs in the wild from eating from their diet. Yeah. But you know, a couple generations of captivity of feeding them, they'll de-evolve, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, and we had a paper a number of years ago with some collaborators that looked at island dwarfism in boas, and you know, they were not genetically very distinct from mainland animals. Like the island boas were not genetically distinct remarkably from each other.
Right, because you know, it's diet sculpting them.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Yeah. Speaking of that, we should talk about, you know, this is kind of like a gray area as far as islands. Like, you're familiar with the Paraguaná Peninsula of Venezuela?
Which one? Sorry, you cut out again. Oh, you cut out there. Which island?
The Paraguaná Peninsula in Venezuela.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, that's not really an island.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to call it a peninsula, too, because it looks like a lollipop. There's like a natural causeway, and then the peninsula around. Mm-hmm. And that has that's like a desert. You know, the north coast of Colombia and Venezuela is dry; it's desert.
Right. Yeah.
You know, rattlesnakes and cactus and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But on this, there's mangroves around that, and there's a somewhat interesting boa that lives there. That acts like it's like an island boa, even though it's not an island.
Yeah, it looks
like it's so, birds.
Mangroves. But they've got the body shape, I think, of like a Colombian boa, but they're just way smaller, right?
Yeah, they're smaller in the face. The face seems to be, the face reminded me of like a rainbow boa face.
Interesting. Okay.
In a picture.
And it's not uncommon to see that, you know, whenever you see animals that become specialized on different diets. It's not uncommon to see, especially in boas, you see a lot of head morphological variation based on island boas and mainland and food driven.
Right. Because there's a study that I thought about doing that I just never got around to it with my buddy Vin Russo. I'm sure you guys know him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He works with all the island boas. And our idea was to, you know, use either a high-speed camera or a radar detector to measure the strike speed of the island boas as opposed next to mainland boas. Mm. Because it's like you notice, like in captivity, or at least with the imports, you know, a lot of the island boas, when they were still importing, would have their faces banged up.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was because of, you know, they're bird eaters and they strike way too hard in the small cases and cages, and they bust their faces up.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. That's an idea that I had that I think could be worth looking into.
That makes sense to me because, you know, these things are small boas that are perched on branches waiting for passerines to come in. And those birds, you know, they're very flitchy and they'll you know, flighty, and they'll detect a boa very rapidly. So they have to move fast. And that doesn't surprise me. You know, and it also it also supports the idea that things like corallus, most corallus are not bird eaters because they're terrible at striking. You know, they're floppy and kind of ridiculous.
Sleeping birds can be had.
Right. That's a different story. Something that's sleeping. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a different niche.
Yeah.
So, I'm curious to see, I mean, on that peninsula, the Paraguaná Peninsula in Venezuela, I'm sure there's Russian burgeri there as well.
Oh yeah, I would
because
be shocked,
you know, that. Yeah, I'd be. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see like how those live by side by side with the Paraguaná Peninsula boas.
Yeah, I'll have to talk to a couple of people that I know that work with island boas in general, from wild. Like these have collected them in the wild. And in fact, the source for a lot of Vin's animals were from a friend of mine. So I'll have to talk to him about whether they've actually looked at any strike distance or sorry, strike speed in those island versus mainland. Cause they've got a large group that they work with and they're always looking for.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it wouldn't be something hard to do.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think strike speed, but also constriction pressure as well, because
I hadn't thought about.
To constrict a bird is a lot less than what it would take to constrict a rodent.
Yeah, it's on the subject of that. Nice. When I went to the Pearl Islands, mm-hmm. you know, collecting the Sabogai,
yeah.
We found what those were, the ones that we collected. We were there at the perfect time of the year, which was September, which was like the feeding season for them migrating. And what those puked up, the ones that we collected, puked up was swallows, yeah, more than right. anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what type of swallows? What time of year was that?
It was September.
Interesting. So it depends on what species of swallow it was and whether they were coming in. So there's a bunch of swallow species in North America, and they migrate down and they overwinter in Argentina.
Right.
And as a result, when you look at the migration patterns of these, like even cliff swallows that we find commonly here in the U.S., they you know, they go from Texas all the way up to like Nebraska and further. And when you look at their migration patterns from trackers that have been put in them, you know, they go all the way down to Argentina. So clearly some of them follow the land and follow, you know, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, you know, Costa Rica and so on. Others go over water. So it wouldn't shock me that these would be roosting on, you know, at least landing on some of these islands. And therefore, you know, they at that point they're perfect prey for those little island boas.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting that it swallows. I'd love to know which species of swallows.
That I couldn't tell you. I'm not talking about one or two either. You know, they all, or not all of them, but a lot of them had swallows in them.
Yeah.
And some of them had like 10 or 12 in them. Some of the big females.
Oh yeah, my feeling is that for those, a lot of them are just gorging, you know, because they feed for such a short period of time.
Right, exactly. That was how I got those. I mean, I know boas are typically not the hardest animals to breed, mm-hmm. but you know, the way I cycled them in CR was to, you know, just double up the feeding in September and October.
Yeah,
and feed them light for the rest of the year,
and that's what I was telling Keith this. Recently, you know, I moved from Oklahoma to Virginia. My animals were fed very, very sparsely whenever they were at a friend's house for 6 months in Tennessee. And whenever I got them back, I fed them really heavily to put weight back on them. And I've never seen so many ovulations within a short period of time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what they're designed for. Like,
yeah. It really shows you the impact of fasting and then that real significant impact of whenever they start feeding and they gorge. How that then switches that reproductive system on.
Yeah, that's pretty typical for tropical species. It's like, you know, a lot of Americans and Europeans are under the illusion that it's temperature based.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, people will cool stuff down and like hibernate it, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But that's not really what does it. It's the period of inactivity and then pounding the food.
Yeah, yeah, which ties into the wet and dry season.
They did a formal study on those the ridgetail monitors, the Acanthoris,
mm-hmm.
Because people were breeding those and by hibernating them, but they showed that it was the food spike that
it was the real trigger
that got them to ovulate and breed.
Yeah, yeah, and that makes sense. You know, that makes sense.
But so we got some. I'm sure we don't have unlimited time, so we can talk about some other boas. I'll move south. I've been on Corn Island as well.
Nice.
Okay. And boas there are pretty common and pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
My comments on the Corn Island boas are, it would be interesting, especially, you know, you're a genetics guy, but okay. Corn Island is one of the wettest places in this hemisphere.
And it's just east of Nicaragua, right?
Yeah, right. It's Nicaraguan territory. At Bluefields. Yeah. Bluefields is the wettest. It's the most rainfall of any spot in our hemisphere, either in our hemisphere or in Central America. I can't remember which, but it's a dripping wet place. But what's interesting about Corn Island is there's a lot of the species that occur there, like Pseudolaphe flavirufa and Amoeba, what used to be Amoeba. I don't know if they're Huscolus now. Huscolus undulatus. Undulatus is the species. I don't know what they call the genus now.
Right.
Those are dry forest species. Okay. And those are the nearest range is in north, the nearest with the both the flavirufa and the Amoeba undulata. The closest place you can find them is northwest Nicaragua. You don't find them on the coast. You don't find them anywhere else. But I mean, to me, I think that's interesting because it's like, it goes to show that they were probably historically, I mean, you know, tens of thousands of years ago on the mainland, on the Caribbean coast, but then they got out competed when the habitat changed. So it's not the climate that they couldn't handle. It was the competition. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to see if those boas, for whatever reason on Corn Island, were genetically close to the boa, closer to the ones from the drier areas of Nicaragua.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Sadly, the you know, there's just not the samples for that to test it. But I've always, you know, because I love Corn Island boas, and I regret not getting Corn Island boas. I remember whenever that ship, the original shipment came in, you know, 25 years ago, because a friend of mine got some of them into the UK and he distributed them from there. And they're really interesting and unique boas in their own right. And, you know, so when we look at the Corn Islands, like there's two islands almost side by side, right? There's a north one further up north. I forget what it's called.
Like, I wouldn't say they're side by side. I went to the smaller island as well, and that was a long boat trip in heavy seas.
It was. Maybe it was longer
because of the seas, but it was not a hop, skip, and a jump.
Right. Did you find boas on that island?
No, I did not. I looked for them. There's an account of one by Jaime Villa from that island that they said it was very dark.
Right.
Very, very dark snake. And, you know, I searched high and low, but I didn't find any.
Right. Okay.
But on Great Corn, they're pretty common.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, they're not common in captivity anymore. They took a little spike for a while and then they, they weren't a color morph. They weren't a, you know.
Right. People didn't appreciate them for what they are.
Yeah. They have the same happens with many species. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's kind of interesting. Like, I mean, this is a little off the subject, but it's like we've been getting at the facility here, we've been getting a lot of zoo surplus. Uh-huh. And it's all this stuff that used to be, you know, the highest profile in the 90s.
Right.
You know, like Angolan pythons and Madagascan ground boas and stuff like that, mm-hmm. you know, that the zoos are losing interest in. But, I mean, I still think they're cool, so, you know, bring it on.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you can get Madagascan ground boas, then definitely take those.
we've got two pairs.
Wow.
We got two pairs of them.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, because talking to Dennis as well a few weeks ago, you know, I was asking him about annulated boas, and he said there's no point in breeding them because the other zoos aren't interested in taking them.
Right. I mean, I'll take on the subject of annulated boas. I'm glad you brought that up again. Something like that was very interesting that I can share about annulated boas in Costa Rica mm-hmm. was, you know, I kept and bred those for the whole time I was there. Yeah. And it was like it got to a point like they would always give birth when it was raining. If it would start raining at like 4 a.m. in June and July, you know, I would wake up and just say like, okay, I'm going to have a clutch of annulateds this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which brings us on to another interesting subject, because it's like, you know, there's got to be some control of where I think they have more control of where and when they give birth than we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. So it's like when you think about it, that's a perfect time to give birth, because it's like, you know, the afterbirth, that's all going to get washed away from the rain, right, and they're going to be less vulnerable. And it's when the nighttime predators are starting to turn in.
Yeah.
But what lends to that theory is, I've got a buddy, a local guy named Alexander England, who works with a lot of tree boas. Tree vipers.
He's in Texas, right?
And what he determined, this is fascinating, that if you feed the babies within the first 24 hours after birth, they're going to grow a lot faster and be a lot stronger than ones that you wait a week for.
Interesting.
Which I thought was fascinating. And, mm-hmm, you know, I copied that idea with, you know, he did it most, he works with Atheris.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I copied that with Bothriacus. I did it with Marchi. Mm-hmm. And he was 100% right. The Marchi, you know, that ate within, I mean, not all of them will eat, but, you know, maybe like 6-8 out of 10 would within the first 24 hours. But it was a life changer for those. And my friend, my Ecuadorian friend who I mentioned before, she did the same thing with a bunch of her baby vipers. And I thought that was fascinating. But it's like, you know, the point being, it's like if a gravid snake, you know, they're going to maybe capable of waiting for the rains and then go make their way down to like a temporary frog place where frogs are breeding, mm-hmm, and then they'll give birth in the rains then. And
yeah, it's interesting you say that. You know, so there's 2 points I want to make, or one point and then one question. But you know, when you look at a neonate Corallus, other than Caninus, when you look at neonate, you know, whether it's Grenadensis, Portulana, you know, Rischenbergeri, Annulatids, unlike a boa imperator, they don't come out with big bellies full of yolk.
Right.
Right. They're slender, you know, so right, the idea that they're waiting, you know, to absorb that yolk is not the story there. That's not happening there. And in fact, what's interesting this year is that with the litter of Trinidads that I had, they shed their skin within 15 to 20 minutes. Some of them were shedding as they were being born.
Right.
You know, and one of the things that triggers shedding is the stretching of the, or it's believed to be the stretching of the stomach from the yolk being absorbed, or from the yolk, and then that decreasing. And then right, once they've done that, there they put a little growth spurt, and then they go. So to see these Trinidads shed as soon as they were being born, you know what I should have done and what I didn't. I did what I normally do with Corallus, is if I waited and a few weeks to make sure they were hungry, and of course they weren't, I probably should have offered them food that night or the next night to see what they
right would do. That's a mistake that I made as well in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, my logic was to, you know, let them absorb the yolk sac and then wait till they're very hungry before you offer them what is not their natural diet.
Right.
But I couldn't have been any more wrong.
Yeah.
But you know, also on the subject of shedding, you know, after birth, mm-hmm, that could have to do with the level of predation that they're facing, because I published an article in Herp Review with Harry Green, mm-hmm, and Gordon Schuett about, you know, these cantiles that I had, a cryptic form of Belliniatus that would guard their babies until the first shed.
Yeah. Very common, you know, that's pretty well, in vipers and pit vipers.
Yeah. That's pretty well, that's well documented, yeah, in
vipers.
Yeah, and rattlesnakes, but this is the first case that we could find of a tropical viper doing that. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, you know, when you think a level of parental care, you know, it's like after they shed, the babies are going to be less vulnerable because they're going to have less smell on them.
Yeah.
And that's one way of dealing with that. And it's like a venomous snake, you know, mm-hmm, you know, an Echistrodon is a fairly formidable snake.
Absolutely.
So if the babies hang around the mother until they shed, you know, that's one way to skin a cat, mm-hmm, you know, for Corallus babies, you know, if they shed right away, that's another way to deal with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's super interesting. So the other question I wanted to bring up with that there was, and this is something that both myself and Keith have experienced, and that has been parturition in Rischenbergeri that has been extended over multiple days. You know, so I've seen, and it was Costa Rican animals. I came in one day. I used to keep my Costa Ricans in my office at my old lab. Lord. I worked in one day, and the female had given birth to, I think, maybe 4 or 5 babies. And this is like a 6.5-foot snake, maybe 7 feet almost, that eats medium to large rats. And I was sitting thinking, why are there only 4 or 5 babies in this enclosure? It doesn't make any sense at all, because she should have a lot more in her. And 4 or 5 days later, she delivered the rest.
And that has never happened to me.
And the same year, the same thing happened to Keith as well. I think he had, what, 1 baby born, and then a handful of days later, he had another group born as well. Right, Keith?
Yeah, I think she actually dropped on 3 different days before they were all out. And, you know, they did well and everything. It was no, I didn't have any problems with the babies or anything, but they definitely dropped over like a 3 or 4 day period.
Yeah, that has never happened to me. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is it, well, the difference is that, you know, with you being able to keep them in Costa Rica in outdoor enclosures or enclosures where, you know, you get that heavy rain and so on, where we're not giving them that in captivity to the same extent. I wonder, is it just a...
Right. I mean, I don't remember the Ruschenberger and Batesai births being so tied to the rain as the annulatus was. It wasn't in sync with a certain time rains. The annulatus, you know, you could almost predict it like clockwork.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Yeah, that's really cool. I'll have to think about that, you know, whenever I eventually get, you know, because I've got annulatus, but I don't have a male. So I've just got a bunch of females that are sitting around and growing and doing their stuff until I track down a male that I want.
But, okay, well, we're going to be getting some annulatus soon from a zoo. I can't even remember who it was.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, maybe we could work something out in the future, depending on the sex ratio that we get.
Yeah, sounds great, yeah. So here's another species, or another maybe an island form. Have you ever looked at Boa nebulosa or Boa orophius in the wild?
No, I have no experience with those. God, zero.
All right. Well, there goes my questions.
Yeah. I know there was some in captivity in Russia.
Yeah, just not a lot.
There was some guy, maybe you guys remember it, years ago, where he had a fight. He was in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. Who had a fight with his girlfriend, and then he videotaped himself getting, he had let a bat black mamba bite him and videotaped himself. You remember that?
Yeah. I think he had a Orophius. Yeah, I don't know if he had nebulosa, but he definitely had, I think, a Orophius from what I remember.
Yeah,
that's crazy. Yeah, just a lineage that or a species, because they're definitely a species that were in captivity for a little bit, but they just disappeared.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? In the old days, people took stuff for granted.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, but it's like those would, you know, a prime example of that, you know, going off boas and into pythons or Dunn's pythons. I remember Dunn's pythons in the UK 25, 26 years ago coming in through an importer called Liz Phillips. And these things were like, you know, the equivalent of like $100 or less each. And nobody wanted them because they looked like a small Maclots python, and Maclots at that point were just, you know, flighty, bitey snakes. So who wanted them? And then they disappeared. And it's only recently that a couple of people have been able to source those and breed them again. I've got a pair downstairs, and they're super interesting snakes. You know,
I'd be interested in some of those when you.
I'll send you some. Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, there was somebody promised me a pair of those, but then they. Then after that, I never got a straight answer.
Oh, really? You know, I'd be happy to send you some. Yeah, hopefully next year my female will be big enough. But I'll send you some whenever I get them.
Yeah, keep me in mind. I would be very interested in that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah. So what about then if we go further south? What about other boa did you go into like Argentina and see?
No, I've never. I've never been in Argentina, so I know nothing about Occidentalis. Yeah. I've been in Paraguay, but I never saw any boas there. I saw yellow anacondas. I mean, that's a boa.
Oh, cool. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
But let's talk a little bit about Unguliophus.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a very neat snake. Here's what I get to say about Unguliophus. They're the ones from the Pacific coast are completely different from than the ones from the Caribbean coast. Mm-hmm. In Costa Rica, the ones from the Pacific look a lot more like a continentalis.
Right.
They're a lot more slender, and you know, it's like I have angliofish and long lives, so I kept. I remember keeping like a Pacific one. I had Pacific ones and Caribbean ones side by side, the same cages and the same diet for years and years and years. And the Pacific ones stayed slim, and the Caribbean ones were a lot heavy bodied. So it's not an artifact of captivity.
Interesting.
For the Caribbean ones being thicker.
Yeah.
Those are more common than people give credit for. They're just not often seen.
Yeah. So whenever I saw them at La Selva Biological Station, it was always around tree falls, recent tree falls. Whenever, you know, the trees came down, there's a bunch of bromeliads on the ground. And, you know, if you were there pretty soon after a tree fall, then we were likely to see one.
Right. It's kind of funny. All the years I spent in Costa Rica, I never saw in angliofis in the jungle. They were they were always in people's houses I even get angliofis occasionally in my own house, you know, because waking up one time and I had these like a reading lamp and looking over and there was an angliofis skin right on the reading lamp.
Wow. That's cool. Yeah.
But, you know, they're very tolerant of urban sport.
Yeah. Right.
What's that?
I see a handful of them popping up again in the U.S. You know, not commonly anymore.
But. Yeah, but I believe it's continentalis that the ones are showing up, the ones out of Mexico.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to Boas, Boas, Boas. This episode with Quetzal has been super entertaining. We've definitely touched on a lot of things with him, but there's definitely a lot more to talk about. So this will be episode one of our interview with Quetzal, and we will let you all know when we're going to have episode two. For now, check us out on the NPR Network's YouTube channel and the website at MorallyPythonRadio.com. You can follow us on most podcast apps, including iTunes and Spotify. We hope you'll join us next month on the episode of Boas, Boas, Boas. We'll be chatting with Quetzal again for part two. Until then, enjoy your animals and follow your passion.